While there are some people today who consider New York politics to be completely dysfunctional, it wasn't long ago when that wasn't even a serious debate. In many ways, modern American politics grew out of efforts to bring exploding, ungovernable, corrupt, colonial-era cities and states out of the 18th century and into the 20th. It was a particularly colorful and arduous journey in Albany and New York City. Daniel Citrom is the author of New York Exposed, the Gilded Age police scandal that launched the progressive era. In the old days, he says, police were not officers of the law. No. They were strange neighborhood dictators. And most people thought that was fine until it wasn't.
Individual police captains were, in some sense, like little emperors. They ran their precincts like fiefdoms. The other thing to remember here is that there's an interesting, I think, understanding that in New York in the Gilded Age, the property elite, the bankers, the real estate people, the merchants, they didn't really care that much about the police taking money from brothel keepers or from saloon keepers or being involved with the vice economy of the city. They didn't really care about that as long as the police department kept its boot on the neck of the labor movement, political radicals, and protests of all kinds. And the cops are incredibly brutal toward trade unionists, protesters, people on the streets. It's not really until the Lexow investigation, this investigation by the state Senate, that the depths of police brutality begin to be revealed.
And then we talk about the machines that operated in politics, yes. And Tammany Hall, for instance, and the money in politics. Describe how that worked.
I think that Tammany Hall machine represented a notion of politics as business. And when you think about it, it made a lot of sense. Remember, if you're living in New York City in the 1890s, there's no Medicare, there's no Social Security, there's no unemployment insurance, there's no minimum wage, there's none of the social safety net that we take for granted today. And so the question for so many thousands and thousands of people was, you know, if your kid gets in trouble with the law, if your apartment burns down and you need a place to live, if you're unemployed for a long period of time, who do you go to for help? And most people, you know, the answer was the local political ward boss, the local ward healer, the representative of the Tammany machine. In effect, votes in exchange for services. The Republican Party has a machine as well. But it's based not in the cities. It's based not in the immigrant working class. It's based in the federal government. Parkhurst and reformers of his ilk argued for a nonpartisan approach to politics. They believe that you can only really get at the problems of the cities in particular with a more nonpartisan professional approach. But that went directly against the very, very deep American belief in partisanship.
This is such an important moment because it seems as though one segment of America was saying, all right, the way to get ahead is just sort of to compete in the system, basically join the gang and try to get ahead just like anyone else. And it didn't matter whether you were Republican or Democrat or what party you were in. It was just join the system and, you know, spin the wheel, which is very, very familiar today. And then these progressives are saying, no, in fact, this system fundamentally doesn't work. And the only way to ask questions about governance is to really back away and at least dare to abandon this system. And that's really, you know, very much what Bernie Sanders is saying today. It's what Teddy Roosevelt said, sort of.
To take a longer view, John, I think one of the things that's going on in this period around the turn of the century is the beginning of a fundamental transformation in the Democratic Party. So that the Tammany Hall machine mostly emphasizes, as I said, services for votes, negative government, local autonomy. But the challenges of the Depression of the 1890s, the emergence of a trade union movement, the emergence of socialists, and also progressives like Roosevelt and others, forces the Democratic Party to change its tune. And, you know, in the wake particularly of the Triangle Fire in 1911, what you see is Democratic Party saying, look, we have got to harness the power of the state to improve the lives of ordinary people. And that turns out to be a great vote getter as well.
And the characters that came out of this moment are the investigative journalists, the voice of the crusader politicians, the populists, the, you know, messianic figures as well.
Let's not forget the emerging role of women. This is something I get into, too, that a part of this progressive movement, of course, of the women who established social settlement houses, people like Jane Addams, Florence Kelly, and Lillian Wald, they're offering, I think, a different vision of progressivism, which is based more on social justice. They don't just want to control these people. They don't just want to, you know, repress their drinking and so on. They want to bring them into the mix of American citizenship and the American public life.
I do hear from your work in this book that there was a consensus in the 1880s that politics was business. And the progressives came in and said, no, politics is something else. It's bigger than that. It's an issue. It's a mission. It's a calling. It's not until 1980, when Ronald Reagan gets elected, do we move back to, no, politics is business.
The larger point, I think, is that, you know, if you say, well, what impact did the progressives have on governance? What you can see, particularly on the city level and on the state level, is progressives taking over some governments. For example, the whole idea of the city manager movement, the idea that the people running the city should be above politics, nonpartisan, not representatives of the political parties. That becomes adopted by hundreds of cities in the progressive era. If you look at the state level, look at places like Wisconsin, for example, and also New York, all of a sudden you're beginning to get more and more legislation, more and more laws being passed aimed at regulating the power of big capital, providing more services for ordinary working people. And that, I think, is a very important legacy as well. One of the things that's revealed in the Lexow Committee investigation of the NYPD is the practice of basically having to pay $15,000, to raise $15,000 in order to become a captain. Now, $15,000 in the 1890s today is the equivalent of over $400,000. So in effect, what happens is if you want to become a police captain, you've got to gather the money from your various friends and political acquaintances, grease the wheel, so to speak, and that's how you became a captain. So there was a tremendous amount of outrage about this. And the investigation also revealed that there were regular consistent payoffs that were made to the police, not just by brothel keepers, saloon keepers, gamblers, counterfeiters, but also by respectable businessmen, steamship lines, construction companies, and so on. So the police are not only the managers of the vice economy, but they also have a grip on large aspects of the city's economy at large.
Daniel Zittrom, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, John. Pleasure to be here.
Daniel Zittrom is professor of history at Mount Holyoke College and author of New York Exposed, the Gilded Age Police Scandal that Launched the Progressive Era.